The failure of drug war is glaringly obvious to judges, cops, wardens, prosecutors, and millions more now calling for decriminalization, legalization, the end of prohibition. Let us investigate the Century of Lies.
Hello, and welcome to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. This week, more from my conversations with Lil Prosperino, Southern States Regional Organizer for the National Harm Reduction Coalition, and with Avi Yocheved, a harm reduction activist and member of the Portland Drug User Union.
My name is Avi Yocheved. I am a person who has lived experience with drug use, and I have turned that into both an activist and human services career. I'm a member of Portland Drug User Union, which is an advocacy group around the public health needs and civil liberties of people who use drugs. And I'm also a peer support worker at a needle exchange program. I have done work in terms of decriminalization in the drug policy world. And that is kind of the world in which I do the most of my work and advocacy.
Back in the 1970s, in the beginning of Nixon's war on drugs, they realized that the marijuana laws were excessive and being perceived as excessive, and so a lot of states enacted decriminalization, and that kind of pushed things off for quite a while. The impetus for legalization was reduced because fewer of these middle class kids were being arrested and put in jail. They might get a ticket. They'd still get arrested, and it still goes on the record, but they could forget about it years later, and nobody pays attention, because they're middle-class white kids. And then, I mean, it wasn't until the 90s that we finally pushed medical marijuana through in California, and then the realization was, oh, we have to give them something. And so they'd fight against it, but still, it was with one hand tied behind, and ultimately they had to give us medical marijuana, and even to the extent of legalization. I mean, medicalization, they fought too hard, and we had to make it legal instead. And with the same with these with the supervised consumption sites. I mean, when Insight started, that was 20 years ago. You know, the U.S. knew what was going on in Canada. Hell, we were the North American Opioid Medication Initiative, NAOMI. Initially, the idea was that there would be a NAOMI site in the United States to gather data about U.S. U.S. experience. But John Walters, the drug czar in the GW Bush administration, said no, because they always just say no to, smart moves. So the U.S. didn't participate. And that was 20 years ago. Now we've reached the point where the state, it's that thing where it's like, they'll throw out the reform, a little bit of reform here, a little reform there. A few years ago, they finally opened up some of the funding for syringe service programs, or syringe exchanges. Can't use them to buy syringes yet, but, there's still the ability to get some money. That little reform that was thrown out so that, harm reduction advocates and people who just care about human lives would just quiet down and stop advocating and making noise about all these dead people. And, it hasn't worked. So anyway, we've got in Washington State, they're calling them community health engagement locations. And in Rhode Island, where they just passed the bill, they're calling them harm reduction centers. And supervised consumption sites have been in use around the world for a long time. And I know that advocates in Oregon have been working for a couple of years now, at least, to try and get this life-saving intervention approved. Could you talk to me a little bit more about supervised consumption sites and why we need them now?
Yeah. First of all, I just want to point out something really crucial that you said just now, which is that a disturbing thing is that drug policy seems to be driven forward by when, young white middle class folks are dying. And that's kind of allowed marijuana exceptionalism and psychedelic exceptionalism in the movement, basically drugs that can be passed off as like palatable therapeutic or recreational drugs that are being used by non-marginalized populations. But I think one of the things that has jammed up the movement for things like supervised consumption sites is that the most critical harm reduction interventions are for the drugs that are under the most systemically dangerous conditions that are being used by more marginalized populations. And that is where we just get into complete gridlock on making those changes, because people simply don't start paying attention and valuing lives until they look like, until they look like me. Even as someone who uses more stigmatized drugs, I have to be very aware of the fact that I am a young white person who looks a very specific way in this movement. And One of the biggest things that I have to do is like push for interventions that do not leave behind people whose drug use and whose social location are not going to be seen as palatable to these like step-by-step reformers. But yeah, supervised consumption sites. So kind of the foundation of what they are is that there's like two components to it that come to mind. The first component is just the immediate safety component. They are a space that is staffed by medical professionals. They're a space that have sterile supplies and naloxone and overdose reversal equipment and medication. And basically a person can go and use their substance. And if they have an adverse health outcome or they experience an overdose, the idea is that people can step in and intervene and prevent that from being fatal. So that's just the tip of the iceberg. A bunch of other things happen at these sites. Like any harm reduction intervention, if it is done correctly, it can be an entry point to any number of services. Of course, the media really, really likes to focus. I don't like to say the media because it's a very complicated set of entities, but popular coverage of safe consumption sites tends to focus on entry point into abstinence-based rehab, which is true. If and when people need detox and rehab services, one of the things that is most effective at getting people into quality programs has been places like needle exchanges or supervised consumption sites in countries that have them. Places where people are being met where they are with low barrier services, and then trust is built, and then people are able to seek out whatever services they might need, and the service itself is allowing them to have the day-to-day stability to start to make some self-effective changes. But what doesn't get, I think, half as much attention is that for many people, that self-effective change might not be a traditional rehab program. You know, some people do not want to stop using all substances. Some people don't even want to stop using one of the substances that they use. So some other wraparound services that supervised consumption sites can link to include like housing services, general like trauma-informed care around mental health, more equitable healthcare services for things like pain and actual health issues. Like if done right, these centers can be a jumping off point to so many needed resources, food resources, family resources. And it is really my hope that we can implement them in a way that doesn't just make them complicit in cycling people back into the same under-resourced systems and cycling them back into the criminal justice system. And I definitely don't want it to just be, you know, a pipeline to very insufficient rehabilitation programs. I say insufficient because when a program does not address the systemic conditions surrounding why someone is struggling with their use, it's just a kind of moralizing program that costs a lot of money and is not based in up-to-date evidence. But yeah, so there's crucial imminent safety, right? You get to go to someplace every day. You don't have to use on the street. You don't have to use somewhere where you're afraid someone's going to come around the corner and arrest you and take your stuff and your money and your livelihood. You don't have to use in unsanitary conditions, and you can literally have the backup plan that if you do experience an overdose, you will have someone to resuscitate you. And that is all the more crucial because unlike people who choose to drink alcohol, which, you know, as you know, is another substance that can have dependency, that can have addiction, that can have physical health consequences, but we have the autonomy in the United States to buy unadulterated alcohol. And so, what we have that could be compared to supervised consumption sites is a lot less medical. We have social spaces where we can use alcohol openly and supervise each other as a community. But when you use something like heroin or methamphetamines or cocaine or any one of these unregulated drugs, you don't have these protected spaces at all, and you don't have a safe supply. So without a safe supply, the next best thing is these sort of, I almost like to call them like overdose crisis triage centers, because truly they are not, I think a lot of people treat them like the most radical intervention. Like, oh, if we had safe spaces for people to shoot heroin, like that would be the furthest that we could go. And to that I say, no, absolutely not. The furthest that we could go is making opiates not such a hazardous and illicit and dangerous thing to be using. But kind of for the scary conditions we find ourselves in, I think supervised consumption sites are beyond necessary. And it's like, it's at the level of like having a public health crisis and not have to not have a clinic or an emergency center or somewhere to go to even try to stem the bleeding of what's going on. So part of it is just having a space to land in the chaotic landscape of the overdose crisis and the hostile network of policy that we have now. Like even if even as we're working to change those other things, at least we have kind of a triage center, a space to check in, a space to go where people have your back and where you're able to receive just bare minimum life-affirming services. And then the other component of it is that community connection. Like, you can get connected to a needle exchange program. You can get connected to methadone or Suboxone if you're interested in those resources. You can get connected to detox if and when you want that. You can get connected to other healthcare, other mental health care, housing services. So it kind of becomes a hub for people who use drugs to access the systems that really have not been made accessible to us, because the people who, I mean, ideally, the people who staff a safe consumption site are going to be people who have connections to those resources, have connections to those institutions, and can help folks navigate them. It's like a low barrier space where people can come in off the street, use the substance that they need to use that day for their routine, and use it safely, and then amidst that routine, if they have any set of needs that they want help at, you know, getting answers for, that can ideally be a site to do that. So notably, there has never been a fatal overdose recorded at any supervised consumption site internationally. And they have had very high rates of connecting people to different needed services, and they have not contributed, even though neighborhood associations and opposing groups love to say this, they have not contributed to elevating quote unquote drug crime in those areas, which I do want to say that idea of drug crime is very politicized. And it's again, demonizing a set of conditions that was in many parts created by the institutions that are criticizing it and policing it. But that is a straw man argument that gets thrown back at us. Oh, it's going to increase drug crime. And it's like, if you break down what those words actually mean and you look at the research, no, it has not. It has actually given people a safer space to do all of those activities that these exact organizations don't want in their backyard. So ironically, some of the organizations that oppose these sites, if they gave one a chance, they might enjoy the results of it, right? If these are the same organizations that are saying, I don't want people shooting up in my backyard. Well, we don't want to have to shoot up in your backyard. We want a safe, sheltered place to go. We want to be able to have our medical needs met. You know, that's the whole point of medical services, is people have bodily autonomy. People engage in all sorts of behaviors that involve health risks. One group should not be relegated to not being able to access those services or not being able to have that dignity. So that's sort of what supervised consumption sites do. Is they're like, I would say, a important place of refuge amidst the conditions of the war on drugs for safety and resources.
I'm speaking with Avi Yochaved, who's a harm reduction advocate, member of the Portland Drug Users Union. So yeah, while we still have some time, talk to me about Safe Supply.
So Safe Supply for me really speaks to the disconnect where a lot of people are on board with harm reduction as a like public health measure at the bare minimum, right? Like people can get their clean needles and then I don't want anything to do with what happens after that. Safe Supply really kind of strikes at the heart of what authentic harm reduction is, which is an intersection of, yes, good public health, but also civil rights, human bodily autonomy. If you are a person listening to this who likes alcohol or tobacco, or in some states, marijuana, you are very capable of going to the store and purchasing that substance without jeopardizing your criminal record. And, you know, that packaging comes with exactly what your dose is, what the ingredients are. And if you were to go to the liquor store and purchase a bottle of alcohol and it contained something else than what it said, and that thing caused an overdose or caused you to become sick or injured, there would be an uproar. There would be lawsuits. People would be demanding their money back. People would be demanding monetary compensation. People would be demanding that their health costs were covered, right? We kind of have in this country, with the substances we have a longstanding culture around, this idea that we do have the bodily autonomy to alter our consciousness and to take certain substances. But that goes out the window when it comes to substances that have been criminalized. And I would like to say that the reasons for that have often, I mean, the party line has been that it's to prevent addiction, prevent negative use of harmful substances. But if you really look at it, like alcohol still causes more deaths than even illicit opioids in the long run. And we still maintain that it's possible to have a decent relationship with it and that people have the right to decide whether and how they want to use it and access resources if they do struggle with it. Safe Supply proposes the same idea with drugs that are not alcohol. It's just that we've been living in the dark ages with those drugs. because of largely racist and classist policy, drug laws that were formed really as xenophobic or racist or classist interventions to suppress marginalized communities and to maintain control of existing systems. We have so thoroughly bought into the propaganda that those are protecting our health when really they're fueling, like I said before, iron law of prohibition. With every prohibition-based drug law, it just pushes the supply into a less safe place. It doesn't actually change the demand or anything about the complex reasons people use drugs. So safe supply is a pragmatic idea. It's the idea that people are going to use drugs, and the best that we can do is give them the bodily autonomy to know what they're putting in their body, when, how much, and to know the risks of that, but to ultimately be able to make that decision. And so there's a few different models that can look like. In British Columbia, there is currently a medical model that was developed under COVID-19 because they were seeing that the pandemic was exacerbating the overdose crisis and vice versa. And so people can now go to their provider and say, I am using heroin, I'm using this much, or fentanyl, I'm using this much a day, and this is, you know, about this much a day. And that provider can then get them access to a clean pharmaceutical grade opioid that has basically the same effect profile and can dispense that. And that person can continue to make the choice to use that drug. They're just no longer at risk for, you know, having a random hotspot in a bag that ends up killing them, or having like an abscess that rots off their arm. It really is just like, and a lot of people then turn around and say, you know, this is not a solution to addiction. Well, it's not trying to be, you know, just like people are going to choose to use substances. People are going to have a range of experiences that are good, bad, and ugly with those substances. And the point of safe supply is just starting from a place of basic human rights and public health. Like, some of these harms are preventable, let's prevent them. Just like we, you know, when alcohol got banned and people saw that there were more illnesses and injuries associated with the underground supply of alcohol, prohibition got repealed. And I mean, I'm not naive. I know part of the reason prohibition got repealed was also taxes. But essentially, we're still living in the dark ages of illicit drugs. And so there's just a few different models. And what this, again, allows to happen is it allows people, even if somebody does have a very chaotic and addictive relationship with a substance, it like essentially makes it so that those people can access services that they might need without being in war zone conditions where they're fighting for their life every day. And I think it lays the groundwork for people to be able to have a more informed, consensual, thoughtful relationship with substances. I think we would see a decrease in problematic use if we had safer supply and more pragmatic education. So I described the medical side of it, but very briefly, there is also medicalization is not the end of the story. We're talking about a population that has been disenfranchised and treated like second-class citizens by the medical system for ages. So I think part of safe supply pragmatically is decriminalizing things to the point where communities can kind of do safe supply ourselves as well. And there's an organization in British Columbia called Drug User Liberation Front that really embodies that. They have put together their knowledge to form kind of as an act of civil disobedience, an underground buyers club that occasionally surfaces above ground to say, hey, we're going to do a demonstration for Overdose Awareness Day. We're going to do a demonstration for, you know, whatever event is happening that commemorates the overdose crisis. And what they've done is they've compiled their knowledge of underground drug markets, and they've been very open about this as a show of civil disobedience. They've compiled their knowledge of things like dark web markets and like in-person drug markets, and their knowledge of safety and security and technology like mass spectrometers. So they're basically taking the best that they can get from the illicit supply. They are testing it to the best of their ability to find out what's in it. And they are packaging it with information and making that available to drug users. So they are kind of doing a on-the-ground grassroots buyers club approach to safe supply. And part of the way that they're able to do that is like the degree of decriminalization that exists in their area. And they are pushing the envelope. They're kind of pushing it as hard as it can be pushed. And I think stuff like that is very important too. Just as it's important to have doctors be able to dispense injectable hydromorphone or diazepam for folks who are opioid dependent and relying on the illicit street supply in order to, you know, decrease very, very high risk health outcomes and just provide basic bodily autonomy. It's also important that someone grow poppies and not be arrested for growing poppies and having their own opium, or, you know, figure out with other people who use drugs how to have a more safe, less like corrosive, less dangerous drug supply through community organizing. So it's really at the root of it, it's a philosophy that people deserve bodily autonomy over what they put in their body, and that the war on drugs has taken, like, if you look at the inherent risks of opioids or stimulants in a vacuum, they're not that much more risky. And you know, some of them in some areas are less risky than drugs like alcohol or tobacco. The conditions socially that we've put them in, the set of laws, the relegating them to the criminal world has, you know, made them exponentially more dangerous. And Safe Supply says that doesn't have to happen. That doesn't have to stay that way. And so then you start seeing models appear that are medical, models appear that are grassroots and like community organized. And I think that it's going to take a combination of those models to really reach the people who are the most vulnerable in the overdose crisis. Because that kind of thing, like, yes, safe consumption sites push the envelope, but at the end of the day, like, full decriminalization and a regulated, transparent, non-poisoned drug supply are going to be the things that we need to end the overdose crisis. And no, it would not end all drug-related issues, but it would kind of bring things back into like a human rights, humane proportion, and we could work on other systemic issues in tandem.
That was from my conversation with Avi Yoheved, a harm reduction activist and member of the Portland Drug User Union. You're listening to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh.
And that brings me to the second mode of civil disobedience. There's a time when the operation of the machine becomes so odious, makes you so sick at heart, that you can't take part. You can't even passively take part. And you've got to put your bodies upon the gears and upon the wheels, upon the levers, upon all the apparatus, and you've got to make it stop. And you've got to indicate to the people who run it, to the people who own it, that unless you're free, the machine will be prevented from working at all.
My name is Lil Prosperino. I use they, them, theirs pronouns. I'm the Southern States Regional Organizer for the National Harm Reduction Coalition.
Building community and building community for self-advocacy and political action is one of the things that I really appreciate about the Harm Reduction Coalition and about harm reduction advocates and activists around the world, around the U.S., because people who use drugs are so often alienated from the broader community because we use drugs. But NHRC and harm reduction advocates have been doing a really good job of building community. Can you talk about that for a moment?
Sure. Yeah. There's a lot to be said about building community with people who use drugs. You know, harm reduction does belong to people who use drugs. I think there's always been folks in harm reduction who don't necessarily have lived experience, but like want to help. And there's always been, I think harm reduction has always been this interesting convergence of sort of like scrappy grassroots direct action led by people who use drugs and public health, right? You know, state governments, health departments, the CDC, you know. What's interesting about that in harm reduction is those two entities have some shared goals and they have some goals that are not aligned, in my opinion. And so harm reduction has this history of holding that. You know, we at NHRC are trying to hold that in a lot of ways. As somebody with a lot of, not somebody, but an organization with a lot of influence nationally, and a lot of people are looking to us to guide that, or not solely by ourselves, you know, but like, we have a lot of standing, you know, and I think there's like a big privilege and a big responsibility that comes with that. So I'm always thinking about that and like how to show up the best I can. One thing that's really cool about NHRC is like, even if our scope is not like, for example, some of the things I do for my position, my job, are like, they're not like boots on the ground, you know, like, and it would, it, you, as one person, you can't really be boots on the ground for the whole South anyway, you know, that's not possible. But like, NHRC does prioritize hiring people with lived experience, people who do the work on the ground, people who know how to do that. And so because of that, there's a lot of us who are harm reductionists as sort of a lifelong practice and as a job, you know. Not all of us who work there have that kind of like dual relationship with harm reduction, but a lot of us do. And I think that helps keep us rooted in a lot of ways. And so I appreciate that that's prioritized at the organization. Aside from that, I would say just some of the best way to build community, to build power, is to like acknowledge and hold those contradictions about harm reduction and who's at the table, you know, digging deeper than inclusion, but like who's centered at the table, you know? And so just being able to talk about that openly, not that many folks are doing that, sadly, you know, like, you see a lot about it on, what we know and love as harm reduction Instagram, but, you know, it's not always reflected in our everyday, day-to-day in-person conversations and interactions with people. And so that's what I'm rooting for, is like harm reduction as a practice that is part of the way that I interact with other human beings. You know, I think that's what we're trying to build, while holding a lot of complicated nuances about extractive and exploitative systems that we live under, you know?
That was from my conversation with Lil Prosperino, a harm reduction activist and the Southern States regional organizer for the National Harm Reduction Coalition. They're on the web at harmreduction.org. And for now, folks, that's it. Thank you for joining us. This has been Century of Lies. I've been your host, Doug McVeigh. Century of Lies is produced for the Drug Truth Network and distributed by the Pacifica Foundation Radio Network. Please support your local community and public radio stations. Become a member today. You can find this edition of Century of Lies, along with an archive of past shows, at the Drug Truth Network website, drugtruth.net. There's a link there to subscribe to the Century of Lies podcast. We'll be back in a week with 30 more minutes of news and information about drug policy reform and the failed war on drugs. For now, this is Doug McVeigh saying so. So long! For the Drug Truth Network, this is Doug McVeigh asking you to examine our policy of drug prohibition, the Century of Lies. Drug Truth Network programs archived at the James A. Baker III Institute for Public Policy.